Okay, we're beginning here on the first line of Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph. Yesterday we left off with the position of Amar of Yehuda, Eidot HaMecheshet Zoat Zo B'Bedikot K'sheira B'Dinei Memonot. When you have Eidim that are inconsistent in their story with regards to the B'Dikot, the non-essential facts of the case, when it comes to monetary matters, that does not disqualify the Eidim. As we saw earlier in the Masechta, that the Chachamim waived the need for consistency within the B'dikot in order to facilitate liquidity in the market, because we made such a high threshold or demand on the qualification of the Eidim, people wouldn't lend money because they wouldn't be able to find Eidim or witnesses to testify that would allow them then to recover their loans because of that high standard. So therefore, we waive the need for a B'dikot, or consistent B'dikot, with regards to Dinei Mimonot. Rava then qualified that statement of Yehuda and says it makes sense when you're talking about the color of the wallet. It does not make sense when you're talking about the color of the money. And then we had Rav Chista, who came along and seemed to disagree with that and say that even in Dinei Nefashot, that would not matter so much, which is that we don't worry about the murderer's clothing, what he's wearing, or the color of the clothing. We do worry about what the weapon is that he used, but as far as his kelim being shchorim and levanim, that would not only be true by dinei memonot, it would also be true by dinei nefashot. And the Gemara says, yes, we have a difference in opinion over here. Rava thinks that Rav Yehuda believes that this is only a dispensation by dinei memonot, whereas Rav Chista believes that it's even not problematic or does not disqualify the Eidim by Dinei Nefashot. Now we have a dissenting opinion to that which Rabbi Yehuda said. Nardai Amre, Afilo Echad Umer Mane Shachor, Vechad Umer Mane Lavan, Mitzarfim. So against what Rava said in Rabbi Yehuda's position, you have the Nardai over here saying that even if they disagree on the color of the money, as we discussed yesterday, Rash thinks that the color of their money is that the older coins are darker and the newer coins are shinier, or the white coins are the silver coins and the black or dark coins are other metals. But here they disagree on something that seems to be a fundamental part of the case, because it's information about what money was lent over here. The Naradai say that even when you are missing that information, that's still not so essential to the case that we're going to say that the Eidim are not Mitzdareif. Unlike what Rava just said in Rav Yehuda's position, which is, if you get the color of the wallet wrong or the pouch wrong, that's fine. But if you get the color of the money wrong, that is problematic. Mar says, come on, who did Naradai hold like? Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha. Like Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, who we saw in the Braita yesterday, who says that if you have Eidim testify to two events, one of them says, I saw so-and-so on Monday, and he admitted to me that he borrowed money from the creditor. And then the other person says, I saw him on Tuesday, and he admitted to me that he borrowed money from the creditor. Will be mitzareif, those two separate witnessings of the fact that we're looking to corroborate or to make someone liable for. We'll put those together, even though they didn't witness simultaneously the same event or the same transaction. And we saw that Rabbi Shua Makarka allows for the combining of those items. And similarly over here, when you have these Eidim that are giving you disparate pieces of information, in the bottom line, or in the end, the common denominator between them is that this guy owes the creditor money. The debtor is indebted to the creditor the money. It doesn't matter if it was white money or black money. There's an indebtedness here. Where it says, wait a minute, Imor Dishmait Leila Rabbi Shua ben Karcha, Eched Lo Makach Hashua Hadodi. That's only true, Rabbi Shua ben Karcha, is when the two sets of Eidim, that their testimony is not contradictory. Eched Makach Hashua Hadodi, on the other hand, where their testimony is contradictory, Mi Amar, who says that Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha in that instance would agree that we're mitzareif the Eidim. So you can't necessarily say that Naradai is built upon Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha. Because all Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha says is, if I have two Eidim testifying about different disparate events, as long as those two events in some sense could be brought together or find a common denominator between them, then I'll say it's a single testimony and we will obligate the individual or make him liable. But in an instance where I have two Eidim telling me totally different stories, so it's not only that they have a disparate event that they're speaking about, the event they're speaking about actually contradicts each other, because they're not testifying about something that happened Monday and Tuesday, they're both testifying about something that happened on Monday, the same event, and telling us different facts about the same event. Over there, maybe Rabbi Shua ben Karcha would not agree in that case, because there's a contradiction in the testimony of the Eidim. Ela, hu damar ki haitana. The Naradai must be following this Tana. The Tanya, I'm Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. So the Tana that they are following is Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. If you have two sets of Eidim, Shachat Omeret Matayim, One set of Beitim says there's an indebtedness for 200 zuz. Bachato merit manet. And one of them says that there's an indebtedness for 100 zuz. Sheish bechlal matayim manet. Over there, we don't assume that there is a contradiction in the testimony. We assume that they both agree, at least on the 100, that he does owe it, or he is liable for that 100. Aman echluku, what do they argue about? Al kat achat. We have a single kat of edim, meaning that two edim. And each one of the edim gives us a different story. One says he owes 200, and the other one says he owes 100. Shebeit Shammai omrim nechlaka edutan. At that point, we say that the edut falls apart, because basically what Rashi says is, she'achad shakran shubkanen edut. Since we consider or classify one of the edim here as being a liar, then you no longer have a unit of edim that can be put together to make it that we have testimony over here. So Beit Shammai thinks that the problem is, once you have somebody who is seemingly lying over here, you can no longer have a kat edim, because one of them is not telling the truth. On the other hand, with the two sets of edim, even Beit Shammai agrees over there that we can combine the two sets of Edim because there is a common denominator where they are not contradicting. And that is the 100 zuz that both of them agree that he owes. That the second 100 zuz that they are disagreeing about, but at least on the 100 zuz we have a set of Edim that is testifying. Beit Hillel omrim, yesh bechlal matayim manet. Beit Hillel extends the same logic that applies by two sets of Edim to a single set of Edim. With two sets of Edim, we say, if you have a 200 and a 100, we assume that the 200 subsumes within it 100, so therefore both of them agree to the 100. So too, when you have two Edim who are together, a Kat Edim, if one of them says 200 and the other one says 100, we will believe them. The way that Rashi reads it is, Shnei Edim al Maneh, ubalto Maneh, ein machishin zed zeh. There is at least a Maneh about which they don't disagree. So they might be lying about the second 100, one of the two of them is lying about that, but at least a portion of it they're telling the truth about because there's an agreement between the two parties on that 100 zuz. And therefore, they will be qualified or we will consider them to be a good kat edim. So that's one way to read it, that the machloket here between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel is, do we classify the individual as a liar because there's clearly a contradiction? If you have a liar, you can't have a kat edim. On the other hand, Beit Hillel says, yes, they might be lying about a portion, but there's another portion about which we think they're telling the truth. And we will bifurcate that and say the truth part of it will stand. The false statement will then make them in the future disqualified as edim, but it won't disqualify the current testimony that they're involved in. That's the way that Rashi seems to read it. On the other hand, you could argue that Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai are arguing about whether people make a mistake between 100 and 200. We find this many times with regards to Edut, that if Edim make a slight variation or a mistake in their calculation, we'll assume that that is a standard deviation from the norm, or that is the type of statistical error that we would expect. So for instance, if Edim testify that it was on the 4th of the month, and another set say it's on the 5th of the month, we don't necessarily say that they're arguing. We say that one of them knew that the previous month was a 30-day month, and one of them did not know it was a 30-day month. So one of them thought it was 29 and 30, and they're really speaking about the same day of the month. They're just confused. But if they're 2 days apart, you can't say that anymore, and then we say they're contradictory. So similarly over here, can people get mixed up between 100 and 200? Beit Hillel might be saying that you can get mixed up between 100 and 200. This is the view of the Yad Ramah and the Mukhe Yosef, that the machloket between them is whether people do get mixed up between 100 and 200. Beit Hillel says people do, and therefore there's no lie being told over here, or nobody is an age sheker, and that's why they can be mistaken according to Beit Hillel. And Beit Shammai says that people don't make a mistake between 100 and 200. It's too far apart, or it's too obvious. And therefore, they are disqualified as edim because they're considered to be contradictory edim. So now, what the Gemara is suggesting is that the Naradai subscribe to Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar's position in his explanation of Beit Hillel. And so that is that even when you have dissonance or a contradiction in what seems to be integral facts of the case, nevertheless, we will try to as best as possible put it together and then say that this does not disqualify the Edim. The Baal Tosfot over here point out that even though the Gemara here associates the Naradai with the Shita of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, that's not to the exclusion of Rabbi Yehuda. And the Baal Tosfot show from other places in Shas that Rabbi Yehuda himself does subscribe to the position of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. So yes, the Naradai clearly subscribes to Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, but it doesn't mean that then Rabbi Yehuda disagrees with the position of Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, but rather, the Yesh Lomar, the Vadai Itlei Rabbi Shimon Elazar, Ela Shem Chalek ben Maneh Lamatayim, Lemaneh Shachor, Maneh Levan. He just says that, even according to Rabbi Shimon Elazar, There's a difference between 100 and 200 versus white and black. And that is basically what we just said now. There's a possibility that you could argue that 100 to 200 could get mixed up. White and black wouldn't get mixed up, according to that reasoning. Or 100 is subsumed within 200. Black and white are not subsumed within each other. And so then maybe even Rabbi Shimon Lazar would agree. So Rabbi Huda and the Nardai, in a sense, according to the Baal Tosfot, are arguing about what is the extent of Rabbi Shimon Lazar's heter here to ignore contradictions in the Bedikot. When it comes to Dinei Mimonot, how far do we go with regards to ignoring those facts? The Nardai think 100, 200, black and white, all of that gets ignored. And Rabbi Huda suggests that by 100, 200, we would ignore it, but not by the black money and the white money that we would not ignore, because that's something that either they won't get mixed up about, or it's something where you can't say one is subsumed in the other. All right, now the Gemara continues and says, Echad omer chavit shel yayin, v'echad omer chavit shel shemen. You have an individual who come in, two witnesses come in. One says that he owes a barrel of wine, and one says he owes a barrel of oil. Aba obda, it was a case like this, after the coming to Rabbi Ami, and it was brought before Rabbi Ami, Chayvei Rabbi Ami lishlume le chavita de chamra migo chavita de mishcha. He made him pay a barrel of wine out of the total of the barrel of oil. A barrel of oil was more expensive than a barrel of wine. And so basically what he's saying is that the barrel of wine, of course, owes a barrel of wine. The one who says a barrel of oil, subsumed in the barrel of oil, is a barrel of wine. Kiman, who's that like? Mara says again, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, like we saw before, that when you have those types of contradictions between the Edim, that we don't consider that to disqualify them as Edim by Dinei Mimonot. Emar, Damar, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, Eich HaDeish Bichlal Matayim Maneh. Wait a minute. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar only says this statement when the larger number subsumes the smaller number. So you have 200 and 100. So 200 has subsumed in it 100. Ki'ai Gavna Mi'amar. In our case, you think he's going to say that? You're talking about totally distinct objects over here. Talking about wine and oil. How can you say that one is subsumed in the other when they are totally different items? As Rashi says over here, the Trei Minei Ninhu, V'chulehai Mechashe Hadodi Mi'amar. We have such contradictory statements, would you say such a thing? Which means that we can't join these two Edim together. There is a question in the Rishonim as to whether that means that they are totally disqualified and they have no bearing on the case whatsoever, which seems to be the view of the Rambam. Or do we say that these two Edim can't be joined together, but each one of them independently is still valid and can obligate a Shvuah over here, which seems to be the view of Rabbi Yosef Cairo and the Beit Yosef. Lo, tzricha l'dame. It's not a case where he came to court seeking a barrel of wine or a barrel of oil, but rather the value of a barrel of wine or the value of a barrel of oil. So now that we're talking about monetary amounts, now you can speak about one being subsumed within the other. The one who says he owes them the value of a barrel of oil is a larger number. One says it's the value of a barrel of wine, that's a smaller number. And therefore the larger number will subsume within it the smaller number, and that's what it meant here. He pays him the value of a barrel of wine, which is a subset of the value of a barrel of oil. One of them said that the transaction took place on the upper balcony. And the other one says that it took place on the lower balcony. Chanina says that an incident like this came before Rabbi. And he joined their edut together to make them into a single kat edim, so that they could testify and make this person liable for whatever he owed. Now Rashi explains over here, what is Rabbi doing when it says v'tzirei futam? He says, first of all, he holds like Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, that to Yeshua ben Karcha allows us their value, maneh mechayve. Both testimonies say that this debtor is indebted 100 zuz to the creditor. Irrespective of where they think the loan took place, they both agree that the debtor himself has an outstanding obligation of 100 zuz. And this is despite the fact that there's also a contradiction within their testimony, kid Rav Yehuda, like Rav Yehuda we saw before, who says that when there is a inconsistency in the bedikot, that does not disqualify the edim, as long as it's not about something integral to the loan. Over here, where the loan was given, whether it was the upper or lower balcony, is not something that's integral to the loan. And therefore, even Rabbi Huda would agree that that does not disqualify the Edim. So Rabbi, taking both of those opinions and putting them together, came to the conclusion that these are qualified Edim, and they could testify against this debtor. Now, it's not enough to say that it's Rabbi Shua ben Karcha, because you still have a contradiction here. We already said before that maybe Rabbi Shua ben Karcha's din is only true when there's no contradiction. If there is a contradiction, maybe it's not true. That's why we'll enter Rabbi Yehuda to tell us that even if there is a contradiction, we still say that Rabbi Shua ben Karcha's din applies. And now we're at the last line of the Mishnah, which is Umanayin Sheyetzei, where we know the fact that a person who exits from Beit Din is not allowed to disclose the information about how the justices voted or how the justices decided in the case. Tan Rabbanan, Minalik Sheyetzei Lo Yomar. How do we know when you leave Beit Din that the judges should not say, Areini Mizakeh, I said you weren't liable. V'chaveirai Michaivin. On the other hand, my compatriots were the ones who made you liable over here. Aval Maaseh, but what can I do? Shechaveirai Rabu Elai. I was in the minority. They were the majority, and the majority ruled. How do we know that you're not allowed to do that? Tamalomar, lo teilech rachil bi'amecha, ve'omer holeich rachil megaleh sod. So it brings the two psukim that we already discussed in the Mishnah. In the Mishnah itself, it's not clear whether the Girsa included both the psukim, neither of the psukim, or one of the two psukim. You have all different versions of the Girsa. It likely got mixed up with this bright over here, which does include the psukim, and it says both psukim, and we discussed there in regards to the Mishnah why the two psukim might be indicating different aspects of why we don't want people disclosing this information. Ha'utamida denafik alei kala. There was this student in the Beit Midrash who had rumors circulating about him, the Gali Milta, Dietmar Beit Midrash Batar Esumitaratin Shnin, that he disclosed information about conversations or a decision in the Beit Midrash that already was 22 years old. I mean that the information was no longer really relevant. The information was really stale. 22 years ago, there was such a decision. And now he's leaking this information 22 years later. Afke Ravami mi Beit Midrasha, Ravami threw him out of the Beit Midrash, Amar Dein Gale Razio. This guy is disclosing secrets. He is speaking Lashon Hara. Obviously that has to be the problem here, which is that he's saying something that casts aspersions on others and maybe even helps himself out. But because he acted this way despite the staleness of the information, he was still considered to be someone who's not trustworthy anymore because he's disclosing information that should not be disclosed. Next Mishnah. As long as he has more evidence to bring to the case, he can undermine the decision of Beit Din. So it means that even if Beit Din rendered a decision, if he then afterwards is able to bring additional proof or additional evidence, we'll reopen the case and look at that additional evidence. Amarlo, kol rayot sheyesh lecha avei mikan v'ad shloshim yom. The Beit Din says to him, listen, whatever evidence you have, whatever information you have, you must bring over the next 30 days. So there, he finds new information or relevant information during those 30 days, they will unwind their decision or reverse their decision based on the new information. After 30 days, after 30 days have elapsed and he hasn't brought any additional information, then the decision will stand and he will have no longer have a right to undermine it. What's this guy going to do? He just didn't get the evidence within the 30-day period or 30-day window. But after 30 days, suddenly something appeared. Something came to help him. So therefore, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel believes over here that you have an unlimited right to bring additional evidence over here because Beit Din is the one who is imposing this artificial limit on when you can bring evidence to. The Chachamims think that that is binding, and if you go beyond that time period, you will no longer be able to bring additional evidence. Shimon Gamliel says that how could you limit his right to bring additional evidence? He's just not in his control. If it was in his control, then at least we could demand of him a certain time frame or a certain time period. But here where it's not in his control, and he doesn't know about the evidence, whenever it comes to hand, he can bring it, and we will relook at the case. Amarlo, so then if Beit Din says to him, Havei Edim, bring your witnesses. V'amar Ein Li Edim, I don't have any witnesses. Amar Havei Raya, say then bring your proofs. Since I have no proof, I have no evidence. After some elapsed time, he ends up bringing some sort of proof. Or he found witnesses that are relevant to the case and he can bring in. Those are completely meaningless. Because over here, he is perjuring himself. In the first case of the Mishnah, He never makes any declaration or statement. It's Baton that's talking and imposing a deadline on him, and he can't meet that artificial deadline because he just didn't have the information. In the latter half of the Mishnah, the individual is making a declaration that he has no witnesses and he has no additional proofs. So now, when he shows up with those additional edim or additional proofs, he is actually perjuring himself. And that, the Chachamim say, we won't allow, and so therefore the evidence will be discarded. And actually, that's evidenced by the difference in the language in the first part of the Mishnah and the second part of the Mishnah. In the first part of the Mishnah, it says, Eino Soter, that the Chachamim believe that he does not undermine or overturn the Psak of Beitin. Whereas here in the latter part of the Mishnah, it says, Eino Klum, that is completely meaningless. And so the difference is the fact that in the first part of the Mishnah, if the evidence was brought in a timely fashion or within the framework that was given, it would be valid evidence. In the latter part of the Mishnah, whether it's before the Psak Din or after the Psak Din, it is disqualified because he would be perjuring himself after he already stated he has no further evidence to bring. And therefore we suspect, as Rashi notes over here, Chashina Shem Zeif O Sachar Eidim, whether he counterfeited or forged the document or he hired these Eidim. Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel, once again over here, dissents, and says, I'm Rabbi Shimon Gamaliel, my SSS, lo yad yodea sheish lo edim, umatza edim. What are you going to do for this poor guy, who had no idea that there were edim that could testify on his behalf? And then he found them. Lo yadea sheish lo raya, but he didn't know that he had a good claim or a proof, umatza raya. And then, sure enough, he found that proof, or that evidence. So why should he be held accountable for information that he does not know about? And when he made his declaration, he made it in the context of not knowing this additional information. And therefore he should not be considered as if he's perjuring his statement. Ra'a, shemitchayev bedin, if at the last moment he sees that the verdict is going against him or the decision is going to go against him, v'amar kivru ploni ploni v'yaduni. He says, hey, you two over there, come and testify on my behalf. He says, I have edim. Ojotzi raya mitachat pundato. All of a sudden he pulls out an ace from his sleeve, or in their parlance it is, he took out some proof from underneath his belt. That's not considered to be binding evidence. And here Rashi points out that even Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel would agree in this case. Because here there's so much circumstantial evidence that he is lying over here, because he only pulled out these proofs, or these edim, at the last moment, even though prior to this point in time he seems to indicate to us that he doesn't have any more evidence. Or that he doesn't have it a raya. So here, where things are leaning against him and all of a sudden he shows up with this information, there we think that it is suspect. Right? Amar Rabbi Bar Avuna, halacha Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. The halacha follows Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel in the Mishnah. That's the first case in the Mishnah. Amar Rabbi Bar Avuna, ain't halacha kedivrei chachamim. And just in case you weren't sure that halacha is like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, the halacha is not like the chachamim. Gemara says pshita. If you already tell me the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, then obviously the halacha is not like the chachamim. So ma'ud tamer, I would have thought, hani mili lechatchila. That's only true. Lechatchila, we pass like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Avad di'avad, but b'di'avad, shapir dami. We would accept the position of the chachamim. Kamash malan, from that we include the avid mehadrinanle. If he does do it, we reverse it. Which means here it's actually a double negative, because the Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is the one who allows you to overturn the verdict. So then, if you follow the position of the Chachamim over here, then when you bring the additional evidence later on, we won't allow you to overturn the verdict. The Chachamim, who say that you're not allowed to be soter, you're not allowed to undermine the decision, so now if you paskin like them and don't undermine the decision, mehadrinanle. We will reverse it. We will reverse the decision to say like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, which also means that we will then undermine the decision that was made prior to that point in time. Because now you've opened up the possibility with these new ra'ayot to overturn the previous decision. So Amar lo evei edim, Amar Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. So now this is the latter half of the Mishnah, which is Amar Rabbi Bar Huna, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, halacha kedivrei chachamim, as opposed to the ratio of the Mishnah where he passed like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. The latter half of the Mishnah, he passes like the Chachamim. V'amar Rabba bar Avuna, Rabbi Yochanan, ain't halacha k'Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. And once again, he gives both sides. Not only is the halacha like the Chachamim, it is not like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. But it says, pshita, kemen damar halacha k'divrei Chachamim. Since he says the halacha is like the Chachamim, in Meili Adano, ain't halacha k'Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. We know the halacha is not like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Hakamash malon, That comes to teach us the Bahahi and Alakha Krabi Shimon Gamliel. That over here the Alakha is not like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Habikulu, Alakha Krabi Shimon Gamliel. That means, but the implications of that are that anywhere else in Shas, the Alakha would be like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Now Rashi over here notes that the Gemara doesn't say what it said before. In the first case where we pass in Alakha Kir Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and say the Alakha is not like the Chachamim, then we had the Gemara speculate that maybe you would have thought, had I not said in Alakha Chachamim, that maybe Bidiyavad it would have been okay. Kamash Malan, that Bidiyavad it's not okay, and we paskin fully like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. So why couldn't they say the same thing over here? Had you not told me in Alakha Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, I would have thought the Alakha is like the Chachamim, but Bidiyavad, if you do like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, we'll be okay with that. So Rashi points out, you can't say that in this case, because there's a difference in the setup of the Machloket. In the Machloket, in the first part of the Mishnah, we're paskin like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, which goes against the general Klalei Apsak, which is Yachid V'Rabim Alakha Kirabim. We are discarding that normal principle and saying the Alakha is Kirabim Shimon Gamliel. So that's what might open up for us that possibility that Bidiyavad, the Alakha would be like the Chachamim. But in the latter half of the Mishnah, we're paskening like the Chachamim, and we're saying that the Alakha is not like Kirabim Shimon Gamliel. What's that teaching us? Can't be teaching us that Bidiyavad, we don't pasken like Kirabim Shimon Gamliel, because there's no reason to think we should pasken like Kirabim Shimon Gamliel. He's not the Rabim. He is the Yachid over here. And therefore they have to come up with a different reason why we say in Alakha Krab Shim Gamliel. And that is the diuk that is made from that, which says that only here the Alakha is not like Krab Shim Gamliel, but everywhere else in Shas, it is like Krab Shim Gamliel. Lafuke mehad amar Rabbi Barchanam Rabbi Yochanan. And this goes against the position of Rabbi Barchanam Rabbi Yochanan, which is komakom shishana Rabbi Shim Gamliel b'mishnatenu. Anytime Rabbi Shim Gamliel appears in our Mishnah, halakha kemoto. The Alakha is like him, chutz. With the exception of the following cases, which is Marev, Sidan, Viraya, Achrona. So now, Raya, Achrona is our case here. In the Mishnah, you had two cases in the Mishnah of Ra'ayot. The first case where the Beit Din gives him a limited amount of time to bring his evidence, and he brings evidence after that point. The second half of the Mishnah discusses the case where he says, I have no more evidence, and then later shows up with that evidence. And the first part of the Mishnah is called Raya, Rishona. And the latter part of the Mishnah will be called Raya Achrona. And what he's saying over here is the Alakha is not like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel in Raya Achrona, in the second half of the Mishnah. And that's similar to Rabba Bar Rav Huna. Both of them agree that the Alakha is not like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel in the latter half of the Mishnah. Their disagreement is whether there are other exceptions to the rule. Rabba Bar Rav Huna says this is the only exception to the rule. Otherwise, the Alakha will always be like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. On the other hand, Rabba Bar Chanan Rabbi Yochanan says that there are other exceptions to the rule, not only the case here of Raya Achrona, but also the case of Arev that we saw in Baba Batra, and that is, the Mishnah says that there's a difference between a regular Arev and Arev Kablan. If he's a regular Arev, then you have an obligation to go after the debtor first. And if he can't collect from the debtor, do you go after the guarantor? On the other hand, if you have an Arev Kablan, he puts himself on the front line. And that means that the creditor has a right to go after either him or the debtor. He does not have to give priority or preference for going after the debtor, because an Arev Kablan puts himself in as a first line of payment. So over there, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says that even Arev Kablan, you still have to go after the Loveh first, and you can't go to the Arev beforehand. So that's one case of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, where we say the Alakha is not like him. The other case of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is a case in Masechet Gittin, where an individual puts conditions on the granting of a get to his wife. He gives a bill of divorce to his wife, but he has strings, quote-unquote, attached to it, not in the document itself or about the divorce, but he makes a condition. He says, listen, this is your get if you pay me 200 zuz. So the Mishnah says, if he pays the 200 zuz, if she pays the 200 zuz, the get is a good get. She doesn't pay the 200 zuz, the get is not a good get. So now, the case that was brought afterwards was a case where, if he says to her, listen, you can have this get, it's your get, on condition that you give me my cloak. The only problem is that his cloak disappeared, his cloak was stolen, yet she has no way to give him his cloak. So now, does that mean that she cannot fulfill the condition, and therefore the get will fall apart? Or is there an alternative? Over there, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel suggests an alternative, which is the monetary value of the cloak can be used to replace the cloak. That means if she can't give the cloak and have the fulfillment of the condition, she could pay the value of the cloak and fulfill that condition. So in both of those cases, we say, Ein Alakha Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, according to Rabbi Bar Bar Chana. And the third case is our case over here of Raya Achrona. So that is, Rabbi Bar Chana believes that when Rabbi Shmuel appears in the Mishnah, the halacha is always like him, with the exception of these three cases. Whereas Rabbi Rav Huna says that he thinks that the halacha is like Rabbi Shmuel Gamliel across the board, with the exception of the second half of our Mishnah here, or Raya Achrona. So now, how Yonoka, the Tavua Ladina, Kameh the Rav Nachman. There was this youngster that was summoned to court, the case to be adjudicated by Rav Nachman. Amalei Itlach Sadeh, he says to the minor, this young child, do you have witnesses? Amalei Lo, says no. Itlach Araya, do you have any proofs to bring over here? Amalei Lo, says I have nothing. Chayvei Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman obligated him to pay the liability. Have a kabochi v'azil. This young child, or this Yanoka, was going and crying because he had lost the case. Shem'uhu anachinche. These individuals overheard him. Amrulei ani yadane b'mili d'abuch. We are actually very good friends of your father, and we know what happened in your father's estate. Then, Amar Rav Nachman, b'ha afilu rabbanan modeh, t'yanoka b'mili d'abuch lo yada. Rav Nachman says over here, even the chachamim, who normally don't allow you to bring in additional evidence, once you have said that you don't have that evidence, nevertheless, by a kid or a young kid like this, they would agree that you can bring additional evidence, because a child generally does not know all the dealings of his father. And so therefore he doesn't have a full capacity to answer the questions, because he just doesn't know that type of information, wasn't aware of that type of information. Now the Baalei Tosafot already asked over here, and it's posed by others as well, which is, why is it Yanoka? Why is it here that we have a young child being brought to court? In general, we have a position that we don't bring the Yatomim to court, or we do not make them liable for payments, Elohim Kain Rebit Ocheletva, unless you have interest that's eating away at it. In that case, we will compel the Yatomim to either deal with it, or pay it back so that they are not subject to additional losses because of the interest that is accruing on the outstanding debts. So unless there are losses being incurred by the Yatomim, we will not bring them to trial in order to make claims against them until they are of age. So why over here all of a sudden do we have this Yanoka that's found in Beit Din? So the Baalei Tosafot answer and say that Rav Nachman does not subscribe to that position, but rather to Rav, who says that we always bring Yatomim to Din, because we don't want them holding on to money that's not theirs. And therefore, if there are claimants who want to make a claim, then we have the ability to adjudicate that and deal with it even when they are ketanim. Secondarily, then Tosfot asks, don't we have a principle that you're not allowed to adjudicate a case without the baal din being present, without the litigant being present? And over here, the yatomim who are ketanim are not classified as being a baal din. We'll see that again in the Gemara in Shavuot, and we've already seen it previously, that a ketan is considered to be as if he's not there, he's not the baal din. So now you're adjudicating a case without one of the litigants being present. So how is that possible or possible in this case? The Baalei Tosafot, first of all, answer, that principle might apply by other litigants, but by a katan, the presence of the katan is good enough to have it be that it's considered as if the litigant is there. But then Inami, he gives a second answer, which is that here we're dealing with a shtar and the validation of a shtar, and that can be done even without the presence of the baal din, and that's how we accomplish the problem. Other Rishonim, like the Yad Ramah and the Rambam, solved the problem much more easily by saying that he wasn't really a Katan, but rather, similar to the way the Gemara addresses this in other places, an individual is considered to be a Katan b'milei da'avua. When it comes to his father's issues or transactions, he's always considered to be a Katan, even if he is of age. And that's because he wasn't the primary party to the transactions. And so therefore, over here, the Yanoka, we don't take literally that he is a young child, but a Yanoka, because it's a son or a Yoresh versus the father. And then that also will have repercussions to the conclusion of the Gemara that Yanoka b'milei da'avua is considered to not have the full information set that he needs. And does that refer just to a katan, a minor, or does that also refer to someone who's of age, but because he's a Yoresh, by definition, he is considered to be a Yanoka b'milei da'avua? There was this woman who was entrusted as a trustee for a document of outstanding debt. So she takes out the shtar. Amra le yadana by shtar de priya avo. She says that I know that this document was repaid. Hemna Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman believed her and considered the document or the outstanding debt to be repaid. Amra le rovo the Rav Nachman. So rovo the Talmud Rav Nachman says to his Rebbe Rav Nachman, Keman, who's this like? Kirabi? This is following the position of Rabbi. Damar, otiot, niknot, bimisira. Because Rabbi believes that you're able to transfer ownership over an outstanding credit document. So over here, where she had possession of the credit document, then even though the document doesn't have her name in it, nevertheless, she could be the real creditor now because she might have bought the rights of collection. If that's the case, we will believe her because Migo, that she could claim that it was her document. Migo, that she could lie and claim that it was her document. Therefore, she gets Nemanu, the believability with regards to declaring this document as being repaid. Although Rashi seems to indicate that she really does own the document. And therefore, since it is her document, she can tell us whether the document is repaid or not. We're going to believe whatever she says because it is her document. Amalei, Shani Hochis, the Rav Nachman says back to Robo. No, that's not the case over here. De'i baya kalte. The reasoning is not because of Rabbi over here, but rather because of the fact that if she wanted to, she could have destroyed the document. She could have burnt the document and it would not exist anymore. So since she had the possibility of burning up the contract, when she tells us that the contract is repaid, we're going to believe her here as a trustee. Igadamre, some read the story in the following manner. Lohemna Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman did not believe her and did not consider the document to be repaid. Amarle Rova the Rav Nachman. So now Rova asks Rav Nachman in the opposite direction, which is, why don't you say over here that if she wanted to, she could have burnt up the document and that should give her enough standing or believability that if she tells us it's repaid, it's repaid. Since the document has already been, the way Rashi says it has a henpek, it's already been validated and verified in Beit Din, then she doesn't have a right then to say that it was burnt or it disappeared. Since we know about it and we have knowledge of it, that's enough for her not to be able to make such a claim. She can't make that claim. She loses her nemanut b'migo. Now the Baalei Tosafot point out, not only do you need what Rashi says over here, which is that there's a henpek, a validation of Beit Din in the document, but also, not only does it have a validation of Beit Din in it, but also we have seen the document in her hand. So she can't deny the fact that the document is with her. Eitvei Rova Rav Nachman. Rova challenges Rav Nachman's conclusion here in the second Lashon, which is that Rav Nachman did not believe her. Simpon Sheish Alav Edim. If you have a receipt that has Edim on it, Yitkayim Bechotamav. Then you establish the veracity of the receipt by getting the witnesses to testify to the fact that these are their signatures. Ain alav edim. If the receipt does not have edim on it, yatsa mitachad yidei shlish, but the receipt was found in the hands of a trusted third party, o sheyotzei achar chitum shtarot, or it's found at the end of the debt document. The end of the debt document, after the signature is written at that bottom piece there, is that this loan was already repaid. So in all these cases, kasher. In all these cases, we consider the shulver to be valid, and it will act as a receipt on behalf of the debtor. Alma, what you see from this, breita is shlish mehemen, that a third party is believed. Tiyufta de Rav Nachman, tiyufta. This is a serious undermining of Rav Nachman's position, that he would not believe the woman in this case, even though she was a shlish. And yet the breita over here is saying explicitly that if a person is a shlish, then they are believed with regards to a shover, with regards to a receipt. Now Rashi over here explains that the simpon is a shover, it is a receipt, v'yatsa mitachat yad loveh, kemishpato. The person in possession of it is the debtor. On the other hand, if you look in the Baalei Tosafot, the Rabbeinu Tam brings a distinction in language that is used here, which is that a receipt in the hands of a debtor is called a shover, and a receipt in the hands of the malveh, the creditor, is called a simpon. And so therefore, the first statement of the Breita is Simpon sheyesh alav edim yitkayem bechotamav. That simpon means that shover that is found in the hands of the malveh. And then the meaning of the breita of yitkayem bechotamav means that there are signatories also to the shover that appears after the shtar. But the malveh claims that he preemptively wrote that for when the loveh pays him back. And so the Gemara says yitkayem bechotamav means let's check with the edim who signed on it as to whether they were signing on a repaid document or they were doing it preemptively. And then the other suggestion that if it's in the hands of a shlish, it's in a case where the shlish both has the shtar chov in his hand as well as the shover. And the reason they're believed is because migo, that they could have ripped up the shtar chov. Therefore, the shover is considered to be valid in indicating that this shtar chov is repaid. And that is the question of Rava and Rav Nachman, which is, Rava posed the question, why don't we say Migo that she could have burnt it? Rav Nachman answers, because it was validated in Beit Din. So now Rava brings another case with a shover, where we believe the shalish about the shtar chov because of a Migo. And that seems to be, even if it was validated in Beit Din, we would still believe the shlish based on a Migo. And now the Gemara continues. Ki ata Rav Dimi, I'm Rav Yochanan. Olam mevi raya v'soter ad shiistateim tanutav. Rav Dimi, in the name of Rav Yochanan, says that a person can continue to bring evidence and undermine the decision of Beit Din until he basically says, I no longer have any evidence to bring. I no longer have any edim to bring. Once that happens, we would not allow him then to bring additional evidence to the case. Ha-gufa-kasho. Where it says that there seems to be an internal stira in what was just said. Amart istateim tanutav. You said that once he declares that he has no longer any evidence to bring, atan the rabbonon. That follows the position of the rabbonon, that once you have declared you have no further evidence, you can't bring any evidence. Badar amart, and afterwards you said, kirvu ish ploni uploni veduni. So-and-so should come forth and give testimony. Va'atan the Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. That follows the position of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Because over there, the disqualification in the Braita is only when he brings in these edim immediately afterwards. So as soon as he no longer is able to bring or avail himself of evidence, all of a sudden he suddenly finds this evidence. So over there, even Rabbi Shimon will agree that it's disqualified, but the way that the Gemara is reading it is that there's a diuk out of that. It's only in a case where he brings the evidence immediately afterwards, because then it looks like he's lying about it. But if he happens to get evidence later on, then it seems that that would be fine. And that sounds like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel's position. Rabbi says, V'chitei makula Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, if you want to say that the whole statement of Rabbi Yochanan is authored by Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, uprushe kamifaresh, and he's just explicating on the statement of my achistateim tanutav. What is it meant by achistateim tanutav? That is when he says, kirvu ploni uploni veyiduni. So he's blocked from bringing evidence in this type of case. And that's a case where he declares he has no more evidence or edim, and then immediately afterwards he brings them. That is the shita of Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. That is the third case that is brought in our Mishnah where everybody agrees that you can't bring in that additional evidence. Hama Rabbi Barchana Rabbi Yochanan, kol makom shishana Rabbi Shimon Gamliel b'mishnatenu alacha kamoto chutz mi'arev tzidan v'raya achrona. So now, this is what we just spoke about before, that the law is like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and all the Mishnayot, with the exception of three. And so what the Gemara is asking is, how can you suggest over here that Rabbi Yochanan's position is in that of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, when we have this alternate view where Rabbi Yochanan makes it clear that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, first of all, argues on the Chachamim, and number two is that he believes that the halacha is like the Chachamim and not Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. So then why is he making a statement that proffers the halacha based on Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's position? Alekiyata Shmuel bar Yehuda Amar Rabbi Yochanan, the olam mevi rayav soter, a person can bring evidence and undermine the decision, ad shiistateim tanutav, until his evidence is shut down, v'yomru lo, and they say to him, ave edim, v'omer ein li edim. They say, bring witnesses, he says, I don't have witnesses. Ave raya, bring evidence, bring any proofs that you have, v'omer ein li raya, I have no evidence. Aval, bau edim imidinat hayam, even in that scenario, if all of a sudden edim show up from overseas, or there was a sack full of shtarot that was deposited with a friend, he still then has a right to bring over evidence and undermine it. He's allowed to bring that evidence and undermine the decision of the case, because this is really new information. There's no way he could have known that these individuals were coming overseas and were going to help him out. Or he had no idea about these shtarot that his father had left. So therefore, we're not going to penalize him because it's just information that he wouldn't have known about. It's a totally new subject, which is if someone compels the other litigant to go to court with him or to a specific location. One of them says, let's adjudicate the case where we are. The other one says, no, we're going to go to the central Beit Din. Sounds like that's a place where there are lots of chachamim around. This seemed to be the highest Beit Din around, and where all appeals would be brought to. And he thinks that by taking the party over there, he'll be embarrassed to lie because you're dealing with great Tamani Chachamim there. It's a very high level court. Or maybe he's thinking that this court has more ability to enforce their decisions, and therefore he'd rather adjudicate a case in front of them, knowing that they can then enforce whatever the decision is.
So Amar lefanav Rabbi Elazar. So Rabbi Elazar said in front of his Rebbe, Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi, mi shenoshe b'chamiro maneh, person who is a creditor for an outstanding 100 zuz, yotzi maneh, does he have to expend the maneh worth of money in order to protect the maneh that he has? So it doesn't seem to make so much sense that you would have to make such great expenditures in order to end up in the court or the Beit Avad, because you're going to end up spending more money than the money that you lent out is worth. We compel him to adjudicate the case locally.
There is a Tosfot over here that suggests that the rhetorical question from Rabbi Elazar about you're going to expect a creditor to expend 100 zuz to get his 100 zuz back in the end, he'll earn nothing. From here, the Baalei Tosfot want to conclude, and again, there is some view amongst the Achronim that this Baalei Tosfot doesn't belong here, but he says here that Mikan, from here you would conclude, Mitchayev Bedin, that when you lose a case, and you are found to be the guilty or liable party, the lo mishalim leidach yitziotav, you do not have to compensate the other party for his legal costs. Because you see over here that Rabbi Elazar says that the creditor can say, why would I spend 100 zuz to go collect 100 zuz? On the other hand, if the debtor, if he lost the case, would have to reimburse the creditor for his expenses, then he wouldn't mind going up to the Beit Avad, because whatever expenditures he had, he'll recover when the debtor is found liable over here. So Rabbi Elazar says that you do not have a right to drag the other litigant to the Beit Avad, whereas Rabbi Yochanan believes that you are allowed to drag the individual to the Beit Avad. Right now, the Gemara says, Itmar Nami, Amar Reb Safra, a similar memo from Reb Safra, Shnayim Shinit Atzmu B'din. Two individuals are having a hard time getting along with each other, and they've dug in their heels. Echad Omer Nidon Kan, one of them says, let's adjudicate the case here. Echad Omer Nelech Demakom Avad, let's go to the place where the central Beit Din sits. Kofin Oto V'dan Biro. Again, we compel him to adjudicate the case locally. Bim Tzrach Davar Lishol. If they need to ask something they don't understand, or they need guidance from a higher court, they write and send the question off to the Beit Avad, and then they'll receive an answer. If one of the litigants or party says, please give me the information as to why the Beit Din decided the way that they decided, we do document the reasoning and the information, and we give it to him. Now this goes back to a little bit of what we discussed in yesterday's daf as to what type of disclosure there is when there is a conclusion or decision reached by the court. So it seems from this Gemara that the default status would be that we would not document that information. Yes, there would be a court record. Yes, it is a stenographer. But in terms of handing out the psak with the reasoning behind the psak, that would not be made public. Elaim Kane, the person specifically asks for the information to be written down. Now, if he asks for the information, he may not be entitled just to ask for it willy-nilly. It might be that he only has the right to ask for it if he's going to take it to another Beit Din, or he wants to maybe appeal the decision that was rendered by this Beit Din. Or you can suggest that maybe only when we force him not to go to the Beit Avad, he had made a request to go there, and we compel him to stay local in order to adjudicate the case, then he gains the right to have the decision documented, so that he can then take that up to the Beit Avad in order to have them look over the decision that was rendered here. So in that case, they do have to write it down and disclose that information to him. But that means that the default status is that we do not write that down, or we do not document the reasoning and the decision of the case. And the Yavama is obligated to find the Yavam in order to get herself released. Ad kama, how far does she have to go? Amar Rabbi Ami, afilu mitveria letzipori. Even from the city of Tveria to Tzipori, which truthfully is not so far, but she still has to follow him to go there, because Amar Rav Kana, my kra, what's the pasuk? It says, v'karu lo ziknei. So it says there by the Pasha of Yavam that the elders of his city will call him, v'lo ziknei, but not the elders of her city. Therefore she has to go to him, or the case will be adjudicated in his location. Amar Meimar, Meimar says, Elchata kufin oto v'yelech l'makom avad. He believes that we do compel the individual to go up to the higher court or to the Beit Avad. Amar Yavashi, the Meimar, v'amar Rabbi Elazar kufin oto v'dan b'iro. Doesn't Rabbi Elazar say just the opposite, that we compel him and force him to adjudicate the case where we are today, where we're present today? Hani milchei yechit kamerlei lo v'edam alveh.
That's only true when the debtor is the one making the demand to go somewhere else. Aval malveh, if the demander over here is the malveh, and he wants to go to the Beit Avad or to some other court, Eved loveh, the ish malveh, the loveh is basically indentured to the malveh, and whatever the malveh decides, the loveh has to go along with it. Shalchulei the marukva, they sent from Eretz Yisrael and Tveria to marukva, the zivlei ke barbatya, the one who has a countenance like the barbatya. Rashi brings three different interpretations as to barbatya. One of them is Moshe Rabbeinu, who is the son of Bitya Bat Paro. Or, Kibar Batya means Kiben Beite, the person who is like a household member, which is said about Moshe Rabbeinu, that is, B'chol Beiti Ne'eman Hu. And that's what it means here, like Moshe Rabbeinu. Or the third interpretation is a story about Mar Ukva, who was challenged by an Aveira, and he overcame that challenge. And after that point in time, he overcame the challenge, he used to walk around the Shuk, and there would be like a candle, or light that was radiating from above him, which again was comparing him to Moshe Rabbeinu. And the common denominator between all of these explanations is that he had a radiance that emerged for him similar to that which Moshe Rabbeinu had, which was Ki Karan or Panav. And so just like Moshe had that radiance or countenance, so did Mar Ukva. Shalom, greetings to you, Mar Ukva. Ukva na Bavli. This litigant came before us, Ukvana Bavli, Kval Kadama. He complained or brought his complaint before us. Yirmiya Achi, my brother Yirmiya, Hevir Alayat Aderech, did something inappropriate to me. Rashi brings two interpretations. One is that he castrated him, or the other one is that he had some financial misdeeds that he had carried out towards this Ukvana Bavli. V'imrulo, and then you should convince Yirmiya Achi, and then it leaves it as a blank. You should summon him that he should come to see us up in Tveria so that we can adjudicate this case in Tveria. So the Gemara comments on their instructions, Hagufagasha. There seems to be an internal stira here in their greeting. Amart, you said Imrulo, that he should speak to Yirmiya. Alma dainuhu atun. That means that you are asking Mar Ukva to adjudicate the case or deal with this Yirmiya over there. But then you continue and say, Hasiu v'yere panenu b'Tveria, that you should summons him to go up to Tveria or enforce the summons to send him up to Tveria. Almash daruhu halacha. They are requesting that he be extradited to Eretz Yisrael or sent to Eretz Yisrael in order to be adjudicated in front of the victim in Tveria. So which one is it? Do you want Mar Ukva to adjudicate the case, or you want Yirmiya summoned and extradited up to Tveria? The Elohachi Kamre, this is what they meant. Imrulei Dainu Atun. They are saying to him, listen, you adjudicate the case. Itzayit, tzayit. If he listens and he abides by your psak alocha, fine. Ilo, if he doesn't listen or doesn't abide by your psak, hasiuv yeret panenu b'Tveria. Then you should compel him, summons him, and send him over to Tveria because we will enforce whatever verdict it is, or we'll adjudicate the case and enforce that decision. Now, as the Baalei Tosafot point out, it can't be that there was a better enforcement in Eretz Yisrael than in Bavel, because we saw already earlier in the Masechta that they actually had more power, the courts in Bavel, than they did in Eretz Yisrael to compel the litigants to listen to them. And Mar Ukva was Beish Gola, so he certainly had the power to enforce. So the Rabbeinu Tam suggests that it's not that you can't enforce it, but rather he insists on coming up to Beit Din HaGadol and Tveria. If he continues to insist in that manner, you can send him up here and we'll deal with him over here. From here, many Rishonim conclude that you do have a right to demand that you go to the highest level Beit Din, like the Beit Din HaGadol in Eretz Yisrael, even though there is a powerful Beit Din that sits in Bavel. Ravashi Amar, on the other hand, Ravashi makes an alternate suggestion. Dine Knasot Ava. It was a case with dealing with fines or Knasot. Ubavel lo dine dine Knasot. And in Bavel, we know that you're not allowed to adjudicate Dine Knasot because you require Mumchim, because you require Elohim, which is that the Dayan be Musmach. And since there's only Smicha in Eretz Yisrael, therefore Dine Knasot can only be adjudicated in Eretz Yisrael, not in Bavel. So they were telling him, you're going to have to send the case up to us because it's an issue that involves Knasot. So then why did they preface their statement by saying to him, he should deal with the litigant first, and then if it doesn't work out, send him up to us? Why don't they just say straight out, send him up to us? That was all in deference to Mar Ukva, who was the great Reish HaGolah. So they said to him, listen, you can try to deal with him, you can speak to him about the case,
out of deference for Marukva, but they knew he couldn't deal with the case fully because of the problem of Knesset. And therefore, after they gave that deference, they basically told him, send him up to Eretz Yisrael, because we'll deal with the issue of Knesset here in Tveria. And with that, they can complete the third parak, Hadron Aleph, Zeb Borer.